Carlos Castaneda's Tales of Power, Part 1, A Witness to Acts of Power, Chapter 3, The Secret of Luminous Beings. Don Gennaro delighted me for hours with some preposterous instructions on how to manage my daily world. Don Juan said that I should be very careful and serious-minded about the recommendations made by Don Gennaro, because although they were funny, they were not a joke. Around noon, Don Gennaro stood up and, without saying a word, walked into the bushes. I was also going to get up, but Don Juan gently held me down and in a solemn voice announced that Don Gennaro was going to try one more thing with me. "What's he up to?" I asked. "What is he going to do to me?" Don Juan assured me that I did not have to worry. "You are approaching a crossroad," he said, "a certain crossroad that every warrior comes to." I had the idea that he was talking about my death. He seemed to anticipate my question and signaled me not to say anything. "We won't discuss this matter," he said. "Suffice it to say that the crossroad I'm referring to is the sorcerer's explanation. Gennaro believes you are ready for it. When are you going to tell me about it?" "I don't know when. You are the recipient. Therefore, it is up to you. You will have to decide when." "What's wrong with right now?" "To decide doesn't mean to choose an arbitrary time," he said. "To decide means that you have trimmed your spirit impeccably and that you have done everything possible to be worthy of knowledge and power. Today, however, you must solve a little riddle for Gennaro. He's gone ahead of us, and he'll be waiting somewhere in the chaparral. No one knows the spot where he'll be, or specific time to go to him. If you're capable of determining the right time to leave the house, you will also be capable of guiding yourself to where he is." I told Don Juan that I could not imagine anyone being able to solve such a riddle. "How can leaving the house at a specific time guide you to where Gennaro is?" I asked. Don Juan smiled and began to hum a tune. He seemed to enjoy my agitation. That is the problem Gennaro has set up for you, he said. "If you have enough personal power, you will decide with absolute certainty the right time to leave the house. How leaving at the precise time will guide you is something that no one knows. And yet, if you have enough power, you yourself will attest that this is so." "But how am I going to be guided, Don Juan? No one knows that either." "I think Don Gennaro is pulling my leg." "You better watch out then," he said. "If Gennaro is pulling your leg, he's liable to yank it out." Don Juan laughed at his own joke. I could not join him. My fear about the inherent danger of Don Gennaro's manipulations was too real. "Can you give me some clues?" I asked. "There are no clues," he said cuttingly. "Why does Don Gennaro want to do this?" "He wants to test you," he replied. "Let's say that it's very important for him to know whether you can take the sorcerer's explanation. If you solve the riddle, the implication will be that you have stored enough personal power and you're ready. But if you flub it, it'll be because you don't have enough power, and in that case, the sorcerer's explanation won't make any sense to you. I think that we should give you the explanation regardless of whether you understand it or not. That's my idea. Gennaro is more conservative warrior. He wants things in their proper order, and he won't give in until he thinks you're ready. Why don't you just tell me about the sorcerer's explanation yourself?" "Because Gennaro must be the one who helps out." "Why is that so, Don Juan?" "Gennaro doesn't want to tell you why," he said. "Not yet." "Would it hurt me to know the sorcerer's explanation?" I asked. "I don't think so. Plus, Don Juan, please, Don Juan, tell me then." "You must be joking. Gennaro has precise ideas on this matter, and we must honor and respect them." He made an imperative gesture to quiet me. After a long, unnerving pause, I ventured a question. "How can I solve this riddle, Don Juan?" "I really don't know that. Thus, I can't advise you what to do, he said. Gennaro is most efficient. He designed the riddle just for you. Since he's doing this for your benefit, he's attuned it to you alone. Therefore, only you can pick the precise time to leave the house. He will call you himself and guide you by means of his call. What will his call be like? I don't know. His call is for you, not for me. He'll be tapping your will directly. In other words, you must use your will in order to know the call. Gennaro feels that he must make sure at this point that you have stored sufficient personal power to be able to turn your will into a functioning unit. Will was another great concept which Don Juan had delineated with great care, but without making clear. I had gathered from his explanation that will was a force that emanated from the umbilical region through an unseen opening below the navel, an opening he had called the gap. Will was allegedly cultivated only by sorcerers. It came to the practitioners veiled in mystery and purportedly gave them the capacity to perform extraordinary acts. I remarked to Don Juan that there was no chance that anything so vague could ever be a functioning unit in my life. That's where you're wrong, he said. The will develops in a warrior in spite of every opposition of reason. Can't Don Gennaro, being a sorcerer, know whether I'm ready or not without testing me, I asked. He certainly can, he said, but that knowledge won't be of any value or consequence because it has nothing to do with you. You are the one who's learning. Therefore, you yourself are power, not Gennaro. Gennaro is not concerned with his knowing as much as with your knowing. You must find out whether or not your will works. This is a very difficult point to make. In spite of what Don Gennaro or I know about you, you must prove to yourself that you are in a position to claim knowledge as power. In other words, you yourself have to be convinced that you can exercise your will. If you're not, then you must become convinced today. If you cannot perform this task, then Gennaro's conclusion will be that regardless of what he might see about you, you are not ready yet. I experienced an overwhelming apprehension. Is all this necessary, I asked? It is. It's Gennaro's request, and it must be obeyed, he said, in a firm but friendly tone. But what does Gennaro have to do with me? You may find that out today, he said, and smiled. I pleaded with Don Juan to get me out of that intolerable situation and explain all the mysterious talk. He laughed and patted my chest and made a joke about a Mexican weightlifter who had an enormous pectoral muscles but could not do heavy physical labor because his back was weak. Watch those muscles, he said. They shouldn't be just for show. My muscles have nothing to do with what you're talking about, I said, in a belligerent mood. They do, he replied. Your body must be perfection before the will is a functioning unit. Don Juan again had deviated the direction of my probing. I felt restless and frustrated. I stood up and went to the kitchen and drank some water. Don Juan followed me and suggested that I should practice the animal cry that Don Gennaro had taught me. We walked to the side of the house. I sat on a pile of wood and involved myself in reproducing it. Don Juan made some corrections and gave me some pointers about my breathing. The end result was a state of complete physical relaxation. We returned to the Ramada and sat down again. I told him that sometimes I felt irked with myself because I was so helpless. There is nothing wrong with feeling of being helpless, he said. All of us are most familiar with it. Remember that we have spent an entirety of as helpless infants. I have already told you that at this very moment you are like an infant who can't go out of the crib by himself, much less act on his own. Gennaro gets you out of your crib, let's say, by picking you up. But an infant wants to act, and since he can't, he complains. There is nothing wrong with that, but to indulge in protesting and complaining is another matter. He demanded that I keep myself relaxed. He suggested that I ask him questions for a while until I was in a better frame of mind. For a moment, I was at a loss and could not decide what to ask. Don Juan unrolled a straw mat and told me to sit on it. Then he filled a large gourd with water and put it in a carrying net. He seemed to be preparing for a journey. He sat down again and urged me with a movement of his eyebrows to begin my questions. I asked him to tell me more about the moth. He gave me a long scrutinizing look and chuckled. "That was an ally," he said. "You know that. But what actually is an ally, Don Juan?" "There is no way of saying what exactly an ally is. Just there is no way of saying what exactly a tree is." "A tree is a living organism," I said. "That doesn't tell me much," he said. "I can also say that an ally is a force, a tension. I told you that already. But that doesn't say much about an ally. Just like in the cases of a tree, the only way to know what an ally is by experiencing it. Over the years, I have struggled to prepare you for the momentous encounter with an ally. You may not realize it, but it took you years of preparation to meet a tree. To meet an ally is no different. A teacher must acquaint a disciple with an ally little by little, piece by piece. You have, over the years, stored a great amount of knowledge about it, and now you are capable of putting that knowledge together to experience ally the way you experience tree. I had no idea that I was doing that, Don Juan. Your reason is not aware of it, because it cannot accept the possibility of an ally to begin with. Fortunately, it is not reason which puts ally together. It is the body. You have perceived ally in many degrees and on many occasions. Each of those preparations was stored in your body. The sum of those pieces is the ally. I don't know any other way of describing it. I said that I could not conceive that my body, acting by itself as if it were an entity separate from my reason. "It isn't, but we have made it so," he said. "Our reason is petty, and it is always at odds with our body. This, of course, is only a way of talking. But the triumph of a man of knowledge is that he has joined the two together. Since you are not a man of knowledge, your body does things now that your reason cannot comprehend. The ally is one of those things. You were not mad, neither were you dreaming, when you perceived the ally that night right here." I asked him about the frightening idea which he and Don Gennaro had implanted in me, that the ally was an entity waiting for me at the edge of a small valley in the mountains of northern Mexico. They told me that sooner or later I had to keep my appointment with the ally and wrestle it. "Those are ways of talking about mysteries, for which there are no words," he said. "Gennaro and I said that at the edge of the plain, the ally was waiting for you. That statement was true, but it doesn't have the meaning that you want to give it. The ally is waiting for you, that's for sure, but it's not at the edge of any plain. It's right here, or there, or in any other place. The ally is waiting for you, just like death is waiting for you, everywhere and nowhere." "Why is the ally waiting for me?" "For the same reason that death waits for you," he said, "because you were born." There is no possibility of explaining at this point what is meant by that. You must first experience the ally. You must perceive it in its full force. Then the sorcerer's explanation may throw light upon it. So far, you've had enough power to clarify at least one point, that the ally is a moth. Some years ago, you and I went to the mountains, and you had a bout with something. I had no way of telling you then what was taking place. You saw a strange shadow flying back and forth in front of the fire. You yourself said it looked like a moth, although you didn't know what you were talking about. You were absolutely correct. The shadow was a moth. Then, on another occasion, something frightened you out of your wits after you had fallen asleep, again in front of a fire. I had warned you not to fall asleep, but you disregarded my warning That act left you at the mercy of the ally, and the moth stepped on your neck. When you survive, why you survive will always be a mystery to me. You didn't know then, but I had given you up for dead. Your blunder was that serious. From then on, every time we've been in the mountains or in the desert, or even if you didn't notice, the moth has always followed us. All in all then, all I can say that for you, the ally is a moth. But I cannot say that it is really a moth, the way that we know moth. Calling the ally a moth is again only a way of talking, a way of making that immensity out there understandable. Is the ally a moth for you too, I asked? No, the way one understands the ally is a personal matter. I mentioned that we were back where we had started. He had not told me what an ally really was. There's no need to be confused, he said. Confusion is a mood one enters into, but one can also get out of it. At this point, there is no way of clarifying anything. Perhaps later on today, we'll be able to consider these matters in detail. It's up to you, or rather, it's up to your personal power. He refused to say one more word. I became quite upset with the fear that I was going to fail the test. Don Juan took me to the back of the house, made me sit on a straw mat at the edge of an irrigation ditch. The water moved slowly, that it almost seemed stagnant. He commanded me to sit quietly, shut off my internal dialogue, and look at the water. He said that years before, he had discovered that I had a certain affinity for bodies of water, a feeling that was most convenient for the endeavors I was involved in. I remarked that I was not particularly fond of bodies of water, but neither did I dislike them. He said that that was precisely why water was beneficial for me. I was indifferent towards it. Under conditions of stress, water could not trap me, but neither could it reject me. He sat down behind me to my right and admonished me to go and not be afraid, because he was there to help me if there was any need. Excuse me. I had a moment of fear. I looked at him, waiting for further instructions. He forcibly turned my head toward the water and ordered me to proceed. I had no idea what he wanted me to do, so I simply relaxed. As I looked at the water, I caught sight of the reeds on the opposite side. Unconsciously, I rested my unfocused eyes on them. The slow current then made them quiver. The water had the color of the desert dirt. I noticed that the ripples around the reeds looked like furrows or crevices on a smooth surface. In one instant, the reeds became gigantic, and the water was a smooth, flat, ochre surface. And then, in a matter of seconds, I was sound asleep, or perhaps I entered into a perceptual state for which I had no parallel. The closest way to describe it would be to say that I went to sleep and had a portentous dream. I felt that I could have gone on with it indefinitely if I had wanted to, but I deliberately ended it by engaging myself in a conscious self-dialogue. I opened my eyes. I was lying on a straw mat. Don Juan was a few feet away from me. My dream had been so magnificent that I began to recount it to him. He signaled me to be quiet. With a long twig, he pointed to the two long shadows that the dry branches of the desert chaparral cast on the ground. The tip of his twig followed the outline of one of the shadows as if it were drawing it. Then it jumped to the other and did the same with it. The shadows were about a foot long, over an inch wide. They were from 5 to 6 inches apart from each other. The movement of the twig forced my eyes to focus, and I found myself looking with crossed eyes at four long shadows. Suddenly, the two shadows in the middle merged into one and created an extraordinary perception of depth. There was some inexplicable roundness and volume in the shadow thus formed. It was almost like a transparent tube, a round bar of some unknown substance. I knew that my eyes were crossed, and yet they seemed to be focused on one point. The view there was crystal clear. I could move my eyes without dispelling the image. I continued watching without letting my guard down. I experienced the curious compulsion to let go and immerse myself in the scene. Something in me which I was observing seemed to pull me, but something in myself surfaced and I began a semi-conscious dialogue. Almost instantly I became aware of my surroundings in the world of everyday life. Don Juan was watching me. He appeared to be puzzled. I asked him if there was something wrong. He did not answer. He helped me to sit up. It was only then that I realized that I had been lying on my back, looking at the sky. Don Juan had been leaning over me, had been leaning over my face. My first impulse was to tell him that I had actually seen the shadows on the ground while I was looking at the sky, but he put his hand over my mouth. We sat in silence for a while. I had no thoughts. I experienced an exquisite sense of peace, and then quite abruptly I had an unyielding urge to get up and go into the chaparral to look for Don Gennaro. I made an attempt to speak to Don Juan. He jutted his chin and twisted his lips as a silent command not to talk. I tried to assess my predicament in a rational manner. I was enjoying my silence so much, however, that I did not want to bother with logical considerations. After a moment's pause, I again felt the imperious need to walk into the bushes. I followed a trail. Don Juan tagged along behind me, as if I were the leader. We walked for about an hour. I succeeded in remaining without any thoughts. Then we came to a hillside. Don Gennaro was there, sitting near the top of a rock wall. He greeted me effusively and had to yell his words. He was about 50 feet above the ground. Don Juan made me sit down and then sat next to me. Don Gennaro explained that I had found the place where he had been waiting because he had guided me with a sound he had been making. As he voiced his words, I realized that I had indeed been hearing a peculiar sound I thought to be a buzzing in my ears. It seemed to be more of an internal affair, a bodily condition, a feeling of sound so undetermined that it was beyond the realm of conscious assessment and interpretations. I believe that Don Gennaro had a small instrument in his left hand. From where I sat, I could not distinguish it clearly. It looked like a jew's harp, and with it he produced a soft, eerie sound which was practically indiscernible. He kept on playing it for a while, as if allowing me to fully realize what he had just said. Then he showed me his left hand. There was nothing in it. He was not holding any instrument. It had appeared to me that he was playing some instrument because of the manner with which he put his head on his mouth. Yeah. The sound was being produced with his lips and the edge of his left hand between the thumb and the index finger. I turned to Don Juan and explained to him that I had been fooled by Don Gennaro's movement. He made a quick gesture and told me not to talk and to pay close attention to what Don Gennaro was doing. I turned back to look at Don Gennaro, but he was no longer there. I thought he must have climbed down. I waited a few moments for him to emerge from behind the bushes. The rock he had been standing on was a peculiar formation. It was more like a huge boulder on the side of a larger rock wall. I must have taken my eyes away from him for only a couple of seconds. If he had climbed up, I would have caught sight of him before he had reached the top of the dark wall. If he had climbed down, he would already have been visible from where I was sitting. I asked Don Juan about Don Gennaro's whereabouts. He replied that he was standing on the rock ledge. As far as I could judge, there was no one there, but Don Juan maintained over and over again that Don Gennaro was still standing on the rock. He did not seem to be joking. His eyes were steady and fierce. He said in a cutting tone that my senses were not the proper avenue to appraise what Don Gennaro was doing. He ordered me to shut off my internal dialogue. I struggled for a moment and began to close my eyes. Don Juan lurched at me and shook me by the shoulders. He whispered that I had to keep my view on the rock ledge. I had a sensation of drowsiness and heard Don Juan's words as if they were coming from far away. I automatically looked at the ledge. Don Gennaro was there again. He did not interest me. I noticed semi-consciously that it was very difficult for me to breathe. But before I could have a thought about it, Don Gennaro jumped to the ground. The act did not catch my interest either. He came over to me and helped me stand up, holding me by the arms. Don Juan held my other arm. They propped me up between the two of them. Then it was only Don Gennaro who was helping me walk. He whispered something in my ear that I could not understand, and suddenly I felt he had pulled my body in some way strange. He grabbed me, in a manner of speaking, by the skin of my stomach and pulled me up to the ledge, or perhaps onto the rock. I knew that for an instant I was on a rock. I could have sworn that it was a rock ledge. The image was so fleeting, however, that I could not evaluate it in detail. I then felt something in me faltered, and I fell backwards. I had a faint feeling of anguish, perhaps physical discomfort. The next thing I knew, Don Juan was talking to me. I could not understand him. I concentrated my attention on his lips. The sensation had been I had was dreamlike. I was trying to rip from the inside of an envelope film-like sheet that encased me, while Don Juan tried to rip it from the outside. Finally, it actually popped, and Don Juan's words became audible, and their meaning crystal clear. He was commanding me to surface by myself. I struggled desperately to gain my sobriety. I had no success. I quite consciously wondered why I was having so much trouble. I fought to talk to myself. Don Juan seemed to be aware of my difficulty. He urged me to try harder. Something out there was preventing me from engaging myself in my familiar internal dialogue. It was as if a strange force were making me drowsy and indifferent. I fought against it until I began to lose my breath. I heard Don Juan talking to me. My body contorted involuntarily with tension. I felt as if I were embraced and locked in mortal combat with something that was keeping me from breathing. I did not have fear, but rather some uncontrollable fury possessed me. My wrath mounted to such heights that I growled and screamed like an animal. Then my body was taken by a seizure. I had a jolt that stopped me instantly. I could again breathe normally, and then I realized that Don Juan had poured his gourd of water over my stomach and neck, soaking me. He helped me up. Don Gennaro was standing on the ledge. He called my name, then jumped to the ground. I saw him plummeting down from a height of 50 feet or so, and I experienced an unbelievable sensation around my umbilical region. I had the same emanations and dreams of falling. Don Gennaro came to me and asked me, smiling, if I had liked his leap. I tried unsuccessfully to say something. Don Gennaro called my name again. "Carlitos, watch me," he said. He swung his arms at his sides 4 or 5 times as if to get momentum. Then he jumped out of sight, or I thought he did. Or perhaps he did something else from which I had no description. He was 5 or 6 feet away from me then when he vanished, as if he had been sucked away by an uncontrollable force. I felt aloof and tired. I had a sense of indifference and did not want to think or talk to myself. I was not afraid, but inexplicably sad. I wanted to weep. Don Juan hit me repeatedly with his knuckles on the top of my head and laughed as if everything there that had happened were a joke. He then demanded that I talk to myself because that was the time when the internal dialogue was desperately needed. I heard him order me, "Talk, talk." I had an involuntary spasm in the muscles of my lips. My mouth moved without sound. I remembered Don Gennaro moving his mouth in a familiar way when he was clowning, and I wished I could have said, as he had, "My stomach doesn't want to talk." I tried to voice the word, and my lips contorted in a painful way. Don Juan seemed to be on the verge of collapsing with laughter. His enjoyment was contagious, and I also laughed. Finally, he helped me to stand up. I asked him if Don Gennaro was coming back. He said that Don Gennaro had had enough of me for the day. "You almost made it," Don Juan said. When we had been sitting near the fire in the earth stove, he had insisted that I eat. I was not hungry or tired. An unusual melancholy had overtaken me. I felt removed from all the events of the day. Don Juan handed me my writing pad. I made a supreme effort to recapture my usual state. I jotted down some comments little by little. I brought myself back to my old patterns. It was as if a veil had been lifted. Suddenly I was again involved in my familiar attitude of interest and behavior. "Good, good," Don Juan said, patting my hand. "I tell you that the true art of a warrior is to balance terror and wonder." Don Juan's mood was unusual. He seemed almost nervous and anxious. He appeared to be willing to speak on his own accord. I believed that he was preparing me for the sorcerer's explanation, and I became quite anxious myself. His eyes had a strange glimmer that I had seen only a few times before. After I told him what I thought of his unusual attitude, he said that he was happy for me, that as a warrior, he could rejoice in the triumphs of his fellow men, if they weren't triumphs of the spirit. He added that, unfortunately, I was not yet ready for the sorcerer's explanation, in spite of the fact that I had successfully solved Don Juan's riddle. His contention was that when he poured water over my body, I had actually been dying, and my whole achievement had been canceled out of my incapacity to fend off the last of Don Gennaro's onslaught. "Gennaro's power was like a tide that engulfed you," he said. "Did Don Gennaro want to hurt me?" I asked. "No," he said. "Gennaro wants to help you. But power can be met only with power. He was testing you, and you failed. But I solved the riddle, didn't I?" "You did fine. So fine that Gennaro had to believe that you were capable of a complete warrior's feat. You almost made it. What floored you this time was not indulging, though. What was it, then? You were too impatient and violent. Instead of relaxing and going with Gennaro, you began to fight him. You can't win against him. He's stronger than you." Don Gennaro then volunteered some advice and suggestions about my personal relationship with people. His remarks were a serious sequel to what Don Gennaro had jokingly said to me earlier. He said in a talkative mood that, without any coaxing on my part, he began to explain what had taken place during the last two times I had been there. "As you know," he said, "the crux of sorcery is the internal dialogue. That is the key to everything. When a warrior learns to stop it, everything becomes possible. The most far-fetched schemes become accessible. The passageway to all the weird and eerie experiences that you've had recently was the fact that you could stop talking to yourself. You have, in complete sobriety, witnessed the ally, Gennaro's double, the dreamer in the dream, and today you almost learned about the totality of yourself. That was the warrior's feat that Gennaro expected you to perform. All this has been possible because of the amount of personal power that you have stored. It started the last time you were here when I caught sight of you in a very auspicious omen. As you arrived, I heard the ally prowling around. First I heard its soft steps, then I heard Then I saw the moth looking at you as you got out of your car. The ally was motionless, watching you. Was motionless watching you. That to me was the best omen. Had the ally been agitated, moving around as if it was displeasured with your presence, the way it always has been, the course of events would have been very different. Many times I have caught sight of the ally in an unfriendly state towards you, but this time the omen was right, and I knew that the ally had a piece of knowledge for you. That was the reason why I said that you had an appointment with knowledge, and an appointment with a moth that had been pending for a long time. For reasons inconceivable to us, the ally selected the form of a moth with a moth to manifest itself to you. But you said that the ally was formless and that one could not judge its effects. That is right. But the ally is a moth for the onlookers who are associated with you, Gennaro and myself. For you, the ally is only an effect, a sensation in your body, or a sound, or the golden specks of knowledge. It remains as a fact, nonetheless, that by choosing the form of a moth, the ally is telling Gennaro and me something of great importance. Moths are the givers of knowledge, and the friends and helpers of sorcerers. It is because the ally chose to be a moth around you that Gennaro places such a great emphasis on. That night that you met the moth, as I had anticipated, was a true appointment with knowledge for you. You learned the moth's call, felt the cold dust, the gold dust of its wings, and above all, that night for the first time, you were aware that you saw and your body learned that we are luminous beings. You have not yet assessed correctly that monumental event in your life. Gennaro demonstrated for you with tremendous force and clarity that we are a feeling, and that what we call our body is a cluster of luminous fibers that have awareness. Last night you were back again under the good auspices of the ally, and came to look at you as you arrived, and I knew that I had to call Gennaro so he could explain to you the mystery of the dreamer and the dream. You believed then, just as you always have, that I was tricking you, but Gennaro was not hiding in the bushes as you thought. He came over for you, even if your reason refuses to believe it. That part of Don Juan's elucidation was indeed the hardest to take at its face value. I could not admit it. I said that Don Gennaro had been real and of this world. Everything that you have witnessed so far has been real and of this world, he said. There is no other world. Your stumbling block is a peculiar insistence on your part that peculiarity of yours is not going to be cured by explanations. So today, Gennaro addressed himself directly to your body. A careful examination of what you did today will reveal that your body put things together in a most praiseworthy manner. Somehow, you refrained from indulging in your visions at the irrigation ditch. You kept a rare control and aloofness, as warriors should. You didn't believe anything, but you still acted efficiently, and thus you were capable of following Gennaro's call. You actually found him without any aid from me. When we arrived at the rock ledge, you were imbibed with power and saw Gennaro standing there with other sorcerers, where other sorcerers have stood for similar reasons. He walked over to you after jumping from the ledge. He himself was all power. Had you proceeded as you did earlier, by the irrigation ditch, you would have seen him as he really is, a luminous being. Instead, you got frightened, and especially when Gennaro made you leap. That leap in itself should have been sufficient to transport you beyond your boundaries. But you don't have the strength and fell back into the world of your reason. Then, of course, you entered into mortal combat with yourself. Something in you, your will, wanted to go with Gennaro, while your reason opposed him. Had I not helped you, you now would be lying dead and buried in the power place. But even with my help, the outcome was dubious for a moment. We were silent for a few minutes. I waited for him to speak. Finally asked him, Don Gennaro made me leap up to that rock ledge. Don't take that leap in the sense that you understand the leap, he said. Once again, this is only a way of speaking. And as long as you think you are a solid body, you cannot conceive of what I am talking about. He then spilled some ashes on the ground by the lantern covered in an area about 2 square feet. He drew a diagram with his fingers, a diagram that had 8 points interconnected with lines. It was a geometrical figure. He had drawn a similar one years before when he tried to explain to me that it was not an illusion, that I had observed the same leaf falling 4 times from the same tree. The diagram in the ashes had 2 epicenters, one called reason, the other will. Reason was interconnected directly with the point he called talking. Though talking, reason was indirectly connected to 3 other points, feeling, dreaming, and seeing. The other epicenter, will, was directly connected to feeling, dreaming, and seeing, but only indirectly to reason and talking. I remarked that the diagram was different from the one I had recorded years before. The outer form is of no importance, he said. These points represent a human being and can be drawn in any way you want. Do they represent the body of a human being? I asked. Don't call it the body, he said. These are 8 points on the fibers of a luminous being. A sorceress says, as you can see in the diagram, that a human being is, first of all, will, because will is directly connected to 3 points, feeling, dreaming, and seeing. Then, next, a human being is reason. I'm going to get that one again. I missed this one. That a human being is, first of all, will, because will is directly connected to 3 points, feeling, dreaming, and seeing. The next, a human being is reason. This is probably a center that is smaller than will. It is connected with only with talking. What are the other 2 points, Don Juan? He looked at me and smiled. You're a lot stronger now than you were the first time we talked about this diagram, but you're not strong enough to know all the 8 points. Gennaro will someday show you the other 2. We may say that every one of us brings to the world 8 points. 2 of them, reason and talking, are known by everyone. Feeling is always vague, but somehow familiar. Only in the world of sorcerers does one get fully acquainted with dreaming and seeing and will. And finally, at the outer edge of the world, one encounters the other 2. The 8 points make the totality of oneself. He showed me in the diagram that in essence, all the points could be made to connect with one another indirectly. I asked him again about the 2 mysterious remaining points. He showed me that they were connected only to will, and that they were removed from feeling, they were removed from feeling, dreaming, and seeing, and much more distant from talking and reason. He pointed with his finger to show that they were isolated from the rest and from each other. These 2 points will never yield to talking or to reason, he said. Only will can handle them. Reason is so removed from them that it is utterly useless to try figuring them out. This is one of the hardest things to realize. After all, the force of reason is to reason out everything. I asked him if the eight points corresponded to areas of certain organs in the human body. They do, he reported dryly, and erased the diagram. He touched my head and said that was the center of reason and talking. The tip of my sternum was the center of feeling. The area below my navel was will. Dreaming was on the right side against the ribs. Seeing on the left. He said that sometimes in some warriors, seeing and dreaming were on the right side. Where are the other 2 points, I asked. He gave me a most obscene answer and broke into a belly laugh. You're so sneaky, he said. You think I'm a sleepy old goat, don't you? I explained to him that my questions created their own momentum. Don't try to be in a hurry, he said. You will know in due time, and then you will be on your own by yourself. Do you mean that I won't see you anymore, Don Juan? Not ever again, he said. Janeiro and I will be then what we always have been, dust on the road. I had a jolt in the pit of my stomach. What are you saying, Don Juan? I'm saying that we are all unfathomable beings, luminous and boundless. You and Janeiro and I are stuck together by a purpose that is not our decision. What purpose are you talking about? Learning the warrior's way. You can't get out of it, but neither can we. As long as our achievement is pending, you will find me in Janeiro. But once it is accomplished, you will fly freely, and no one knows where the force of your life will take you. What is Don Janeiro doing in this? That subject is not in your realm yet, he said. Today I have to pound the nail that Janeiro put in, the fact that we are luminous beings. We are perceivers. We are awareness. We are not objects. We have no solidity. We are boundless. The world of objects and solidity is a way of making our passage on more earth convenient. It's only a description that was created to help us. We, or rather our reason, forget that the description is only a description, and thus we entrap the totality of ourselves in a vicious cycle from which we rarely emerge in our lifetimes. At this moment, for instance, you are involved in extricating yourself from the snarls of reason. It is preposterous and unthinkable for you that Janeiro just appeared at the edge of the chaparral. But yet, you cannot deny that you witnessed it. You perceived it as such. Don Juan chuckled. He carefully drew another diagram in the ashes and covered it with his hat before I could copy it. We are perceivers, he proceeded. The world that we perceive, though, is an illusion. It was created by a description that was told to us since the moment we were born. We, the luminous beings, are born with 2 rings of power that we use only one to create the world. That ring, which is hooked very soon after we are born, is reason, and its companion is talking. Between the two, they concoct and maintain the world. So in essence, the world that your reason wants to sustain is a world created by a description that is dogmatic and inviolable, with dogmatic inviolable rules, unbendable, I'm pretty sure that means, which reason learns to accept and defend. The secret of the luminous beings is that we have another ring of power, which is never used, the will. The trick of the sorcerer is the same trick of the average man. both have a description. One, the average man, upholds it with his reason. The other, the sorcerer, upholds it with his will. Both descriptions have their rules, and the rules are perceivable. But the advantage of the sorcerer is that will is more engulfing than reason. The suggestion that I want to make at this point is that from now on, you should let yourself perceive whether the description is upheld by your reason or by your will. I feel that it is the only way for you to use your daily world as a challenge and a vehicle to accumulate enough personal power in order to get to the totality of yourself. Perhaps next time that you come, you'll have enough of it. At any rate, wait until you feel like you felt today at the irrigation ditch, that an inner voice is telling you to do so. If you come in any other spirit, it'll be a waste of time and danger to you. I remarked that if I had waited for that inner voice, I would never see him again. You'd be surprised how well one can perform if one is against the wall, he said. He stood up and picked up a bundle of firewood. He placed some of the dry sticks on the earth stove. The flame seemed to cast a yellowish glow on the ground. He then turned off the lantern and squatted in front of his hat, which was covering the drawing he had made in the ashes. He commanded me to sit calmly, shut off my internal dialogue, and keep my eyes on his hat. I struggled for a few moments. Then I felt a sensation of floating, of falling off a cliff. It was as if nothing were supporting me, as if I were not sitting, nor did I have a body. Don Juan lifted his hat. Underneath, there were spirals of ashes. I watched them without thinking. I felt the spirals move. I felt them in my stomach. The ashes seemed to pile up. Then they were stirred and fluffed, and suddenly Don Gennaro was sitting in front of me. The sight forced me instantly into my internal dialogue. I thought that I must have fallen asleep. I began to breathe in short gasps and tried to open my eyes, but my eyes were open. I heard Don Juan telling me to get up and move around. I jumped up and ran to the Ramada. Don Juan and Don Gennaro ran after me. Don Juan brought his lantern. I could not catch my breath. I tried to calm myself as I had done years before by jogging in place while I faced the west. I lifted my arms and began breathing. Don Juan came to my side and said that those movements were done only in the twilight. Don Gennaro yelled that it was twilight for me, and both of them began to laugh. Don Gennaro ran to the edge of the bushes and then bounced back to the Ramada as if he had been snatched to a great, had been attached to a great rubber band that made him step back. He repeated the same movement three or four times and then came to my side. Don Juan had been looking at me fixedly, giggling like a child. They exchanged a furtive glance. Don Juan said to Don Gennaro in a loud voice that my reason was dangerous and that it would kill me if it was not placated. For heaven's sake, Don Gennaro exclaimed in a roaring voice, placate his reason. They jumped up and down and laughed like two children. Don Juan made me sit down underneath the lantern and handed me my notebook. Tonight, we're really pulling your leg, he said in a conciliatory tone. Don't be afraid. Gennaro was hiding under my hat. End of chapter.